Welcome to the Paranormal X Hour. This is Dr. John DeSalvo, and I want to welcome you back. And let's see, I think the most important thing would be to bring on my super co-host, Seraphine Hurley. So hello, Seraphine. How are you doing today?
Hey, John. I'm doing all right. How are you?
You stole my sunglasses.
I did.
Yeah.
Come get them.
Got me mad because I got all set here and I could have had my sunglasses here and we could have matched, but you look good. How was your day? Enjoying the fall or whatever is left of it?
Well, I have a pet peeve today. Pet peeve number 3,028,000, blah, 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 point, whatever, add decimal where applies. I got a little flyer under my door on Saturday night saying that I was supposed to make an appointment because they're trying to get people to come and look at the damage from Irma and for the windows or whatever. And, you know, I'm moving in and everything.
Right.
And before my show and stuff, I get ready, you know, I take my shower and, you know, cause my neck has been bothering me. So I decided to get in the shower again and try to calm down. And no sooner I do that, than I hear bam, bam, bam. And then, okay, there's nobody at the one door. And then there's no, and I'm like, okay, I just got out of the shower. And then three guys are in my living room. So they went from being in the back door to the front door in my living room at the elevator. And I've never gotten dressed so fast in my life.
How come I never got out of the shower and there are three women standing in my living room?
Never happened to me. I don't know.
Maybe there's always be a first. Huh? So
there's a first time for everything. So I wouldn't give up on it just yet.
All right. Well, we'll see. Anyway, well, again, thanks for joining again me tonight, and I'm looking forward to a super show. And I thought a good idea is sometimes maybe bring up a few tidbits at the beginning of the show, some little bits of information people may not be aware of that is kind of interesting. And one of them was, I think I talked to you about it this week. And you saw the movie The Exorcist, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And almost everybody who I spoke to, a lot of people said they didn't see it because they were afraid of it. But I would say about 90% of the people, and the reason I'm bringing this up again now because it's Halloween and people are interested in scary movies, but almost everybody, 90% of people who I've spoken to that have seen the movie said it always left them with a queasy, uneasy feeling, which other horror movies hasn't, especially like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. But yeah. Anyway, I guess. So I thought that was interesting. I mean, I saw the movie opening night in Georgetown, and you know, I taught human anatomy and physiology, blood and guts, all that stuff. Nothing ever bothered me. But I felt kind of funny a little bit afterwards, too, about the movie. And what's interesting was, as you know, I'm interested in exorcisms, and I've studied them and researched them. And a lot of the audience may not know this, but the producer, and I don't have the, I had the information here, and I left it somewhere. I can't remember his name. But when he was... where they were doing Linda Blair, you know, the lady, the little girl who was possessed. Mm-hmm. They were doing her screams, you know, when she was possessed by the demon. He decided to get audio copies of real exorcisms from Rome. And mm-hmm. He superimposed the real screaming of an exorcism by some lady who was possessed into the movie's screaming of Linda Blair. To make it sound more realistic. Yeah. And I thought, you know, it depends on someone's viewpoint of exorcisms, but if there really are demon possessed and anything associated with it is going to carry a very negative and bad feeling. And I always, it's a speculation, maybe the uneasy feeling. I mean, I heard talk to people that said that movie bothered them for months, you know, maybe that had some kind of subconscious effect on people. So it'd be interesting to do more research on it. I don't know how you would do it. But I don't ever remember other horror films having that kind of a mass effect on people. They're not making a remake of it, are they?
No.
I didn't think so. I heard that somewhere, but I thought that was interesting. And I wanted to bring up that, you know, we many times take for granted that paranormal activity is going to be, I don't want to say debunked or explained 10 years from now with new scientific data, right? Mm-hmm. Like a lot of, let's say, psychological problems that people thought people were possessed, like by, you know, there were witches, it turned out they're schizophrenic, or it was caused by hallucinogenics, or they had brain anomalies. And not to say there wasn't real ones, but, you know, we start as technology advances, our medical analysis advances. But I think there's a real basis here for that type of thing. And to what extent, I don't know. The other interesting exorcism was the Amityville Horror. You're familiar with that movie, I'm sure. And a lot of people saw that. Now, which is interesting, such a small world. I didn't realize that. But a lot of people thought it was the Lutz family who basically claimed that the paranormal activity, you know, was happening in the house. Mm-hmm. Well, one of my very close friends, decades ago, he's since passed away, was Chris Gugis. And he was the CIA's top polygraph operator. And I worked with Chris. And Chris told me, he said he was called in by the Lutz family to do a polygraph because people thought they were lying about it. You know, they were faking it. Mm. And they wanted to clear their name. Now, obviously, I think we may have mentioned this before, but I want to kind of tie a few of these exorcism things together. He also did James Earl Ray and told me that James Earl Ray shot Martin Luther King. There was no conspiracy. His polygraph didn't show that there was anything involved. But he basically cleared the Lutz family. The polygraph showed they were not lying. They did not fabricate. Now, that doesn't mean it really happened, but they believed it did. Right. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm trying to show, and there's other examples I could bring up. Some of these experiences, these paranormal experiences, may not be something that science may be able to explain on just a physical level down the line. Maybe there is a real paranormal higher realm causality of it. Wanted to know what your take was on that.
The causality of?
Well, some of these events are real paranormal events, whether they're caused by demons or entities or parallel universe dimensions, but not explainable like, you know, quantum physics or something, but they're real unexplainable events.
Yes, I would have to agree on that. And I don't know if you're aware, but one of the reasons why you don't see the Exorcist movie up and repeated like on Netflix all the time or on Amazon Prime for free all of the time is because it's considered to be a cursed movie.
I didn't know that. Yeah. You know, I've been trying to find it on both of those and I can't half the time. So you just answered a question for me. So if it's a cursed movie, they don't like keeping it kind of up there and
because it's
of
the reaction. Up there. It's up there. You just have to pay to watch it.
I think they classified my press conferences in that category too.
Do you have to pay to watch it?
Yeah. the funniest press conference ever. As you know, I was part of the Shroud. Us, we got to do a show on the Shroud of Turin, but maybe we'll wait for Easter. That's the alleged burial cloth of Christ. I was one of the original research scientists studying it. And I actually had samples removed from it. But I used to go around the country. I was a spokesperson for the team. And actually, I spoke at Loyola University down here in New Orleans. And I hated the cockroaches, but I'm from New York. So, you know, I get adjusted pretty quickly. I really love New Orleans, being a former jazz musician, too. I really got to come back there. Joe's got to take me out and show me the town. You do that, Joe? He's listening. Anyway. But a little sidetrack. But I had this talk at one of the big universities out in California, and they had a big press conference, and the room was loaded with reporters. And I'm wondering, I never get this kind of response. And it turned out the day before my talk, one of the newspapers in California, a big one, mentioned that I was going to be there to speak on the shroud. And guess what? They said I owned the shroud. I'm serious, right? So now I'm ready to go to this press conference. And the guy who's at the university is running a big talk. Mm-hmm. And he said, but you know, the auditorium was packed with 200 people standing, the biggest press conference. I walk into this room, and normally when I have a press conference about the shroud, you know, I may get 5 or 6 people, you know. It was like 20 people, all the major news networks. So either they thought I was a total kook or they believed I owned the shroud. And it was so funny. But anyway, I brought that up. I don't know why I brought that up, trying to be funny, but it's I really enjoy speaking on these different subjects and hearing what people think. And but we'll do that. We'll do a show on the shroud. I think people will be interested in that. We'll maybe keep that for Easter. What do you think, around that time, or even maybe Christmas? We don't want to wait that long.
Yeah, wherever you think's appropriate. But I think, I mean, we could talk about it pretty much any time that we wanted to, because, well, the information, I mean, can go on forever. We could have several shows about the shroud, different aspects of the research. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, no, my work was the image formation theory. I used the VP8 image analyzer, the one that NASA uses to recreate the 3D, you know, spatial images. And one other thing with my trip to New Orleans, if Joe's listening, he'll love this. So after my 1.5-hour talk and questions and display, mm-hmm. I am drenching, tired, thirsty. So. Mm-hmm. A priest comes up to me, because I said when I was speaking, I used to be a jazz musician. Maybe somebody could take me around town. So a priest showed up to me, and it turned out his best friend married my wife and I back in those times. And he said, I'll take you around. So him and the students that were sponsoring the talk brought me around New Orleans. And the first place they took me to, and I don't know, Jeff, is there like O'Brien's? They make the hurricane drinks. Maybe Joe's not there. I don't know, that makes sense. O'Brien's. And I was so thirsty. I said, I got to get something to drink. So they said, we're going to get you a hurricane drink. I said, well, I don't drink alcohol. They said, well, it's just fruit juice. So they brought me this, I swear to God, this thing, this humongous drink. I drank in about 2 minutes. I just was so thirsty.
Could you still stand?
I don't remember much of the rest of the night except seeing the trumpet player out of place. So I have to go back to New Orleans and do the town, this time sober. But I don't drink, too, so can you imagine, hit me both ways. So anyway.
I drink enough for the both of us, so that's
good.
All the hurricanes.
What color was it? Was it red?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that was a hurricane. You're lucky you didn't. He didn't pass out for the rest of the day.
Yeah, that's why I asked if he was standing.
Is that place still around, Joe? It was O'Brien's, if I remember. Is that still there?
Yeah, Patterson's is like 160 years old or something. It's been around for a long, long time. Wow. It's got 5 bars inside of it. It's got the balcony, the porch bar with the eternal fire that burns all year round with the water fountain. It's got the piano bar. It's got the food bar. It's got a couple bars. It's really nice. It's got something for everybody in it, and it's always packed. It's always busy.
I wish I would have remembered that, because maybe I even ate there and I don't remember.
You might have. There's lots of restaurants around there, too. And then right up the street, there's a place that I know Seraphine would love called The Dungeon.
I've been there.
Oh, have you? I love The Dungeon. But I always tell people the same thing. If you don't like being touched, don't go to The Dungeon. It's such a small place, and it's such a narrow place. And I'm a big guy, so when I'm walking through there, you know, unfortunately, people's hands are going to go places they shouldn't. just no room. I mean, you know, the bar's there, the walkway's there, everybody's packed, but a bar is packed in the walkway. Everybody's squeezed through. You get to the stairs, everybody's packed going up the stairs. You get upstairs, the damn room ain't big enough to dance in, but yet there's a dance floor in the middle of it somehow or another. Then they got the 2 cage bars, and they got a private bar up there for guests, for special guests. I've been in a couple of times, but they had Foreigner up there just recently. Somebody else was on there just recently. If you know somebody, you can get it. And they do one of the best All Hallows party anywhere.
Yep.
I mean, they do one hell of a party. Just don't just don't plan on driving afterwards, all I can say.
Wow. Maybe I should come down for Halloween, huh?
It's a great time to be in the quarter. Halloween is. There's a lot going on. But I know I'm probably making y'all's audience crazy listening to my fan buzzing through their ears because I can hear it now.
I love the story. I gotta go back down. Joe, you knew I was a musician, right? Or did you not for most of my life?
No, I did not.
I was a drummer. I actually played with the Jose Melas big band. He was the original band leader of the original Jack Parr show. And I was a kid when the Jack Parr show was on. After the Jack Parr show, which was the first talk show, the Johnny Carson show came on. But Jose was making a comeback back in the 70s, and I was his drummer. And I also played with Clark Terry from The Tonight Show. I played in his band. And Ed Shaughnessy, the drummer on The Tonight Show, was my drum teacher. And I used to go to their rehearsals when they were at the NBC studio in New York. And I was a jazz drummer on some records at Capitol Records. I was like kind of a big time musician, and I wasn't sure if I was going to go into music or to graduate school, to be honest with you. And Clark Terry, again, who was the flugelhorn player on The Tonight Show. I don't know if you remember him, but I remember at one of the concerts, he told my parents, he said, yeah, John should be a drummer. But, John wanted to go to graduate school, be a physicist and whatever. So, that was my life since about fourth grade. And I love playing drums and I love jazz. And I think, you know, maybe New Orleans, I should have on my list to eventually move down there. It'd be really great. And I still would like to get in the band, but I can't find any musicians up here.
Lots of nice, weird clubs in the quarters, not just in the quarter, in the Marinese and Frenchman Street and all up around there. There's like three sections up there that is really nice. It gets touristy some years, but a lot of times, especially in the summer, and there's no tourists down there because only a stupid fool tourist would come to New Orleans in the summertime. I'm just trying to warn y'all people, don't come down here in the summertime, especially if you're up from north. Do not come down here sometime if you're from the north.
No.
Well, you will lose 30 pounds in water the first day you're here.
I got to check with the Loyola, maybe they're going to come down and speak again, you know, with the
but if you come down in the spring and fall, even the winter, it's nice, it's comfortable. I mean, come on, our average temperature in January is 62 degrees, people. A light sweater is plenty good enough to walk around in French. I mean, it gets cold, but it's nice, it's spooky. You know, it depends where you want to go. The museums down there, several museums to go to. There's lots of clubs, lots of bars, and lots of food. But I tell people all the time, if you're coming down for the food, skip the French Quarter. French Quarter is great, but it's for tourists, and it's high priced, and the food's not as good as it is in other areas like in Frenchman and Marigny or up on the side or out, even out in Metairie somewhere. There's lots of good restaurants. You just don't have to eat downtown.
Yeah, I want to, I'm from New York, and I always knew that you got to go to the ethnic places, the places where it looks like you're eating in your kitchen, you know, or their homes.
Oh, the last time I got a porterhouse downtown, it cost me $55.
Holy crap. And
that was just for the steak. There wasn't none with no drink, no sides, no none. It was just the steak. Wow. I think for my wife and I, the dinner that night was like, I don't know, it was $370, $375. I said, really, dude? And I'm not, I can't say what I said on the air, but I just said there should have been some extra condiments. We'll leave it at that.
My fraternity brother was from Chinatown, and we all got a group to go to Chinatown. And he said, I'll take you to the best place. And we're walking. I'm thinking that we're going to go into this big restaurant. And there's an apartment complex. And we go into the apartment complex, go up to the 20th floor. He knocks at the door and opens it up. And it's like a homemade restaurant in there. And they just filled the table up with Chinese food after Chinese food. The best I've ever had in my life. I think there's about 8 or 9 of us. When we were done, it was like $20. And, you know, you just got to know where those places are. But I hope to do that. So let's see. What didn't we cover? How about pyramids? We finished that last week, Seraphine, pretty much.
I just was talking about Egyptology.
Did I mention about the pyramids on Mars, that there are 3- and 5-sided alleged pyramids on Mars? I don't think I did.
Yeah, those are cool. So, but I got a question for you about Egypt. So how old do you think the Sphinx really is? Do you think it's recent, or do you think it's more than 10,000 years?
Yeah, good question. I'll give you my answer, and then Tell you why. Yeah, I think it's more than 10,000 years. John Anthony West, you know, and Robert Schock, who did the pioneering work on that, both were on my board. So John Anthony West was one of my pioneering board members because I'm director of the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association. And Robert Schock, I see him at all the at the expos. Once I was given a talk at one of the expos and on my pyramid research, and I didn't know Robert Schock was there. And I said, Dr. Schock is kind of the people we need in this field. And he was in the audience. So I was very happy. But yeah, I think I do not believe the ancient Egyptians built the Great Pyramid, the Sphinx, or the Giza complex, that it was built by a much earlier civilization. And I agree with you, 10,000, maybe 20,000 years old. And because if you look at the Great Pyramid, it is like magnificent. There's nothing like it. So I think when the ancient Egyptians started their culture, and you know, they attributed the Great Pyramid to the fourth dynasty, to Khufu, it was already there. So now they build pyramids to imitate it. And the problem is none of the pyramids in Egypt come even close to the magnificence of the Great Pyramid. And it doesn't fit in the chronology if you try to classify it, but the academics do it. And the reason is politics. The Egyptians like Zahi Hawass and all those will not want to admit that the pyramids, the Sphinx, and some of these ancient monuments may have been built by a different culture. They want to credit, period. And it's a shame because I'm a scientist and I'm objective. I don't care who built it, you know? I don't care if Donald Trump built it, you know, but I want to know who built the damn thing. Okay. And I go with the facts, but the facts really do not point to ancient Egypt. Is that kind of what you think too, Joe?
Well, yeah. I mean, who was it? Who was the first time I ever questioned it was a gentleman who was working backwards with doing precession, seeing where things were built. And he found out that the Sphinx and the Great Pyramids, the Sphinx lines up with Leo at 12,500 BC, so 12,500 years ago. But fortunately for him, so do the Great Pyramids. They line up with Orion, but only at that date, only at 12,500 years ago. So it's a significant date, but it's more significant than that because we found out that Angkor Wat lines up with Draco at 12,500 years ago. Yeah. We found out the Seven Sisters line up with the seven statues on Easter Island at 12,500 years ago. Yeah. And then there's Stonehenge. So there's something that went on. It, obviously, it was an advanced culture here on the planet. Who it was, what it was, I'm not going to speculate because there's just not enough evidence to do so. But there was somebody here that had a very keen understanding of things like precession, how the planet moved, you know, because if you're building monuments 6,000 years after the fact, then you had to understand the planet wobbles. If you're going to line it up with the constellation, you had to understand something. It just seemed to be a bit advanced for the Egyptians that I learned about originally in school. Now, something else could have done it. Yeah.
Dr. J.J. Hertek, you know, my partner and actually director of our Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association, was the one who'd actually discovered the Orion alignment, never really got the credit for it. And he's the one who worked with the JPL and NASA from, I think it was the 72 flyby. Can't remember. And the Viking one. And also discovered three-sided pyramids in the Elysian Quadrangle. And also in Sidonia, there were five-sided pyramids. But here's really interesting that ties in with what you said. You said something very important, that how could an ancient civilization do this with the precision? And my research with Joe Parr, he was the one on Ancient Aliens who I was talking about his work, discovered in his lab that we could recreate the energy bubble around pyramids and measure it. And we also discovered that the Great Pyramid produces this energy field, and it's dependent on, believe it or not, a gamma ray emitter in the center of our galaxy, not our solar system. You know how our galaxy, all the solar systems spin around it, you know, like a pinwheel. But NASA years ago with weather balloons discovered that there's a big gamma ray emitter. Gamma rays are the most powerful rays. They can penetrate through anything. Nothing blocks them out. So it turns out these gamma, now they don't know what's causing it. They think it could be two black holes circulating around themselves, or nobody knows.
Pulsar or something.
Yeah. So Joe discovered these gamma ray emitters. Oh, I'm sorry, he didn't discover those. So Joe's discovering this energy fields around the pyramids. And guess what? Joe, they vary in time. Sometimes they're strong, sometimes they're weak. He kept a 30-year log of the strength of the energy fields around the pyramids. And then later, after this, NASA released the data of the intensity of the gamma ray bursts from the center of the universe. And whenever they had a large burst, the energy field around the pyramid intensified, almost like a method of protecting the Earth against gamma rays, because they think that's what caused the extinction of the dinosaurs too, was a gamma ray burst, you know, possibly from out in space. And Joe also calculated that the pyramid at that latitude, it's the only place on the Earth that its base would point once a day to the center of the galaxy. Now, is that amazing?
No, it is. Well, you know, a lot of that stuff always fascinates me because Dr. Paul Everett found the cosmic pulse that goes off between every 12,500 and every 26,000 years.
Yeah.
They told him he was crazy until they took core samples in the Arctic and they were like, oh, guess what? The planet is getting hit every 12 to 26,000 years. But those are all interesting things because those have repercussions for future events on the planet. What future events, I guess, is anybody's best guess, but I don't know. I mean, what Lavalette says it is our black hole in our galaxy gives off a pulse every 26,000 years of cosmic rays. It starts flooding the galaxy out as it approaches us. They say you can start seeing it for about 2,000 years because it appears as a really, really bright blue star. And they say you can watch it as it approaches the planet. When it finally starts to get close to us, it forces all the cosmic dust into our solar system, which, of course, in the beginning causes global warming, but then, of course, it triggers an ice age. And then after the ice age, all particulate matter is then settled back into the ground, and, of course, we have a big, beautiful blue planet again. And there does seem to be evidence to support that this does happen on our planet fairly regularly.
Well, we have a cyclic astronomical things that happen. I was going to ask you too, maybe Seraphine too. Do you remember there was a Star Trek episode, something like this, where Kirk lands on some planet and he falls into a pyramid, and the pyramid was supposed to deflect an asteroid
from
Where he got his Indian girlfriend. And only Kirk could find an Indian girlfriend in the middle of that.
Yeah, I like that part. Yeah, yeah. But that's kind of almost similar to what Joe Parr is really saying. Now, maybe that's that funny. Capstone that's missing is a key structure. But who knows? A lot of this is speculation. But you see what we're up against, Joe, when we go to Egypt or when we try to get experiments done. They are afraid we're going to discover something that's going to prove that the Egyptians didn't build it. And I think... you hear Zahi all the time on TV and radio and interviews. Is definitely the Egyptians built it. You know, there were no aliens, no interdimensional beings, no prior civilization. But they can't explain, like you said, look at the technology, look at the things that they produced. It's beyond, in my opinion, a primitive fourth dynasty culture. Now, maybe they have things we didn't know about, but at this point, we don't know what they are. What do you think, Seraphine? What theory do you go with? Would you like aliens and advanced culture, multidimensional?
I think column A, B, and C. 6 of 1, half dozen of the other. Because the limitless possibilities of what's happened, I believe that there was contact with multiple entities possibly at that time, because we have so many things that don't add up, that there's advanced, we have showing that there's advanced intelligence for the time period as we know it. But can you imagine? Well, you can't imagine, but because you've already done the study on it, that there's so many of these things that just scream, we had help from somebody else, outside sources. And then they took their tools and cookies and went home, as far as we know.
That's the problem. You just said it. There's no remnants, you know, of evidence of, and when you think of something, let's say it was a culture 20,000 years old, what lasts 20,000 years, especially, I mean, if you bury it in the desert deep enough and whatever, but unless it's metal or something, it's not going to last. So the chances are archaeologically that we're going to find something is very minimal. But and Joe, I'm sure you remember this. Remember they had the little Gatenberg robot. I can't even pronounce his name. He's a friend of mine. Who's the guy who did the robot back in the old days? He sent it up to Queen's Air Shaft, and they found those doors, like a hidden room. Then they drilled a hole, and they looked behind that, and then there was another door. Yeah. Maybe there's some papyrus. Maybe there's something there. There's some pieces of metal that dropped. And I was hoping they took those out and could take them out and do some kind of dating or material analysis. But again, the problem is if they find something and it points to it not being Egyptian, is it going to disappear?
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. Well, there's all kind of stuff from South America that disappears. And you got to think about the Toltecs versus the Egyptians. They were coming to be in, the Toltecs were coming to be in what, about, what was it, 3,000 years ago, 30, a little bit, maybe more than that, somewhere right around there. The Egyptians were kind of peaking. It's just so weird because there's a lot of similarities between these cultures. I mean, everybody always wants to compare to pyramids, but I mean, they're pyramids, but they're not even close to the same kind of pyramids. I mean, one's built out of big blocks and one's built out of bricks or rocks. No, that might be a better way of saying it. But I mean, they're basically pyramids, but their whole design, the whole way they're put together, structured, even the way they're set up are entirely different. But it is weird that we've got just the ocean separating these two. And at one time, if Atlantis did exist and there was a continent in between the two, it would explain a lot about South America and the Middle East.
It definitely would. I'm glad you mentioned the Toltec. I don't know if you could. I should not have a picture. This is a Toltec. Can you see this?
There you go. Yeah, right there.
Yeah, right there.
That's a Toltec skull that I own, alabaster. It's beautiful. And what's so interesting about it is on the back is a carved statue of a warrior holding the scalp of his enemy. And I've had this looked at by a geologist, and they're pretty sure it's authentic. I'm really into a lot of these artifacts and relics. There's another. So I'm surprised you mentioned the Toltec. They're really an interesting civilization, very warring civilization.
Well, when you do the kind of research I do, everything from the ancient. And you know, one of the first things I tell people when they ask me about research, I said, because you know, when you study looking for things visiting the planet, very first place you got to start is the ancient world. Because anything that was flying prior to 200 years ago or 300 years ago is an extreme interest to me. I'm like, whoa, well, we didn't have nothing. I mean, we had big condors. That was about the only damn thing flying around in the air that was big. I mean, there was no blimps, no balloons, no spacecraft. And the Chinese and the Indians had a pretty good idea of what a comet was because they painted them pretty well back 5,000 years ago. So anything in between that is flying in the sky, it's like, there's a particular story in the Middle East that fascinates me because one of the armies, it was probably during the Inquisition, or probably during the Crusades, but this city had been surrounded and under siege for some time. Nobody was having any luck. They couldn't get out. They couldn't get in. Then one evening, out of nowhere, this big blue shield just came over, hovered over the gates, blew the gates to smithereens, and then the army went and invaded. Now, this is actually a true story. This is real history. But nobody knows what it is or who it was. And both sides, and this is what's so great about this, both sides talked about this thing in the sky that blew the gate up. Now, I don't even know why this alien or whatever it was, I don't even say it was an alien, but whatever it was, decided to take sides here. Or maybe they just got tired of watching this siege go on endlessly. But for some reason, they chose a side and got involved. But from what I understand, that's as far as they got involved. They just blew the gates open and that was it. And they went on their merry way. They disappeared as fast as they appeared. God knows what it was, you know. And it's not the only one. I've heard all kind of counts of ancient flying shields back in the day and flying wheels and all sorts of stuff.
Oh, yeah. And look, even in the Bible, Ezekiel, and you go through even like the Koran, the Dead Sea Scrolls. But, Joe, are you fascinated with this? I've always have been since I was a kid, maybe because my father fought in World War II, is those Foo Fighters. Remember?
Because Foo Fighters are a great thing. I mean, this is 2019 and we still can't do what Foo Fighters did.
I know. Now, The American Air Force thought it was a secret Nazi weapon or Japanese weapon, and they thought it was a secret American weapon. But I mean, that's something almost that's modern, and we know nothing. Or if
the
we do
closest
know something, it's
thing
classified.
We got today, the closest thing you could say today that we've got to it is those swarming drones that we build today. That would be the closest, but that still doesn't compare to what these things did. I mean, they moved at speeds. I mean, they just moved at speeds we just have not achieved yet.
From when
you hear the B-52 pilots talk about them coming from the horizon and back, so horizon 12 miles, they're in and out of horizon in less than 2 seconds.
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of be moving 75, 105,000 miles per second. I mean, just you're halfway to light speed at this point. I mean, these people are just either that or they're popping in and out, which they might be doing too. They might be popping in and out of dimensions. I don't want to rule that out.
Okay. Okay. You got my research now. Okay, now you hit my nerve. Damn you. Okay, my whole research has been for the last 2 years with that former NSA guy who I've been working with is the holographic universe and string theory with the multi-dimensions. And we think because these objects, whether UFOs, whatever, because they're defying the laws of physics, they're popping in like exactly your words, in and out of dimensions, because they're not explainable by the current laws of physics. And we know for string theory to work, you have to postulate at least the existence of 11 dimensions. Now, I know string theory is still speculative, but we're getting into really interesting science here. But if you start looking at dimensions, that these things come in and out, that can explain a lot of it. It could still have a scientific basis. And then the question is, who the heck are these guys, right?
Yeah, and why?
Well, one of my favorite things I ever heard was Einstein. There was a quote that Neil Armstrong used to use the line Einstein's, and he said, "If there's even one other dimension," and at that time we knew there was four dimensions at that time. We knew four dimensions existed at that time, and he said, "If there was just even one other dimension, there were probably countless numbers we couldn't even put on a scale because we simply don't have anything that goes that high. Where are we at now? Google?
Yeah,
I think we're at a Google right now, which is a pretty big number, but still, this would go beyond that. And it also kind of hurts reincarnation theory, too, by the way, but we don't need to get into that.
I agree with you.
Not today, anyway.
I'm not a believer of reincarnation, but every time I say that, I lose a bunch of my friends on Facebook.
Well, because
so I wouldn't say
what?
That.
You know what you can tell them? Reincarnation could be the same damn thing anyway. If there's really trillions of dimensions like everybody says there is, and there's one of you and you broke off into a trillion pieces and each one of you is experiencing something in each dimension, that means you've lived every possible life you could ever even conceive in one lifetime. Then you all snap back together when you die back to one soul. So then you've experienced everything and there's no need for reincarnation. Yes, I can understand why reincarnation people get upset about that. But I don't know. Who knows? It's just theories, man. Nobody knows anything.
I know. Why I like the holographic theory, if this was a holographic plate, remember like in Star Wars where Princess Leia was reconstructed, in a holograph, that if you have a holographic plate and you shine a laser through it, it produces the whole image. Now, if you rip the holographic plate in half. Oh shit, that was my notes for my radio show. anyway, if you ripped it in half. Thanks, Seraphine. Nice to be making ass of myself on, national radio. But anyway, so now you have half and you shine a laser, you think you're gonna see half the hologram? No, you see the whole hologram. You rip it again, every little point on that hologram has all the information of the true hologram. So maybe reincarnation, if we are a holographic universe, every point, and we're a part of every point, has every other point. So we can pick up on, consciousness and lives without reincarnation actually happening to us. What do you think of that? It's a speculation,
That's why I love all of this. I was raised in a science background. Well, I was actually raised in a religious and science background, which is weird to start off with. And, so I could always choose from both sides, whichever one of the arguments I wanted to use. I was well-versed in both. But I've always, because trying to make people understand or getting people to help you to do stuff, you need the base as much in fact as you can, or at least attempt to base it in fact. But some stuff works easy, some stuff don't. People hate aliens and demons and every other damn thing. And then of course now it's October. They love every demon and except for zombies for some reason. We have a morbid fascination with zombies as a human race. I'm not sure what the hell that is. Movies and zombie TV shows. Yeah, just,
yeah. Joe, I pick on zombies a lot. You know why? Because very few people claim to be zombies. So I feel I'm not hurting anybody's feelings.
Well, I got a friend
I'm a hurricane, so I'm a zombie.
Yeah. Well, I got a good friend from Hades who teaches voodoo. And she says she'd turn you into a zombie in less than 5 minutes. And have you walk around, make it. Matter of fact, she said everybody will think you're dead, and then you'll just walk around and do whatever she wants for about like a week before you snap out of it.
I'll volunteer as long as it's fun stuff.
My old girlfriend's high school or college said that about me, so I don't know.
I was just like, look, you know, if it's going to be something fun, yeah. If not, you keep it to yourself.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, by the way, Joe, the other thing, New Orleans, you know, I have one of the largest collections of artifacts from the Marie Laveau mansion when it was liquidated. All kinds of artifacts.
You brought Marie Laveau up. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you're coming down here and you're touring, and there's a lot of fun haunted tours you can take year-round down here. And, you know, some of them, will be honest with you, some of them are just bogus, but they're still fun. But there are some real ones. Don't let anybody tell you Marie Laveau is buried in the cemeteries in the city, because she's not.
She wasn't
buried in the city. She was buried at her very favorite swamp place out in the swamp, outside the city. And when I say that, people are like, well, where you got to go to swamp? Well, in order to find swamp in New Orleans, all you got to do is leave the city on any side. Okay? I'm just not even going to lie to you. There's swamp everywhere, Danny. Well, I mean, New Orleans sits in the middle of the swamp. So she was buried in Honey Island.
One of my friends, Ina, who lives in New Orleans, wrote the classic book on Marie Laveau and her daughter as her PhD dissertation, and she gives tours there. But Marie Laveau...
She still got kin in the city. They say that she's still got family in New Orleans and in France.
Okay. Marie Laveau had a daughter known as Marie Glapion, Glapion. And she was sometimes known as Marie II because they mixed her up sometimes. And then Marie Glapion had a child, Marie Glapion Baptiste, who was like the granddaughter of Marie Laveau. And they moved, I don't want to give out too much information, and had a mansion. And then when she died, it was allegedly and liquidated, and a lot of the artifacts went to a friend of mine, and then a lot of them came to me. And I've had aura pictures done, and psychics look at them. I probably got...
There's probably a lot attached to them, because she did a lot of magic for a lot of people.
Yeah, I got aura pictures of stuff that she had that just blows your mind away. That'd be a fun show to do on aura pictures, because I'm kind of a research specialist on that. So, I mean, see, that's why I love this.
You know, they say that she knew where Jean Lafitte's treasure was buried, too. A treasure that supposedly be worth like $4 or $5 billion today on the open market. They say she knew right where it's somewhere in one of the lower swamps. Everybody is pretty sure about that, but you can't just go dredging swamps, and swamps change. You know, sometimes it's canals and they turn into land and they turn back into canals. It just, you know, it just changes so much. Even places that I grew up as a kid now, some of it has turned into land. It's changed directions, or they've gone through and cut, you know, drilling canals through the middle of it, which changes the whole photography of everything. So it's really weird. But still, every now and then somebody has stumbled across a goal now. There and off the coast of Florida and coast of Louisiana, from now on, time to time, they'll stumble across a Spanish galleon or something.
We got to get my buddy Scott Walter to come down there and do a special on that. He hasn't done that yet, you know?
Well, I tell you what, we get ready to do this. Sometime this month, we're doing the Logtown Cemetery and the Napoleon Cemetery. They're both over 300 years old. And I don't want to call them abandoned cemeteries, because NASA back in the 50s or 60s, I'm sorry, when we decided we were going to start going to the moon, they just came up to the Mississippi, Louisiana line and took over. There were five cities. They just took them over, tore them down to the ground, left the roads, tore everything down, left the water towers in the roads and the graveyards. Everything else got demolished. And a good chunk of that you're allowed to go on and use as recreational area. But the reason they initially did it was because every time they would test an Apollo rocket engine, it would blow the windows out of houses for 40 miles. Wow. So that's only 20 miles short of New Orleans. And if you ever ride it, you'll notice that the buffer zone ends about 15 miles from New Orleans. That's how bad the blasts were. And even today, sometimes you'll be going by there and you'll see big, huge flames going up in the air as they're testing engines and stuff out there. That's a big, huge place. But they left all the graveyards intact. Even today, people still use them and maintain them. So real quick, because I know y'all getting short on time, there was one we go to, very first time I ever went out there with a group. It was foggy, but the fog was only waist high. It wasn't even chest high, it was waist high. And I remember walking through it looking, because you could see the tops of gravestones sticking out here and there, which is spooky enough to start
it's
off
very
with.
Very hammer.
You know, so you're walking along. Well, and I didn't even tell you the whole thing. We'll get to that later. But anyway, so I walk up to this grave, and they're videotaping as we're talking. And one of my friends goes, "Dude, the fog is moving." I said, "You know, it is moving." And well, what the hell is it doing? The fog was lifting up from the ground, coming up to the top of this where it met this, the clean air, and then rolled right back down and just kept repeating that. Like something was moving their hands in the fog, making it roll over. Every grave out there was doing it. No, not the space in between, not the space where we were walking, just the graves themselves. Wow. I said, in old days when you hear the movies getting out, I said, I think that's what this means. I'm getting them out of here. And it was.
And not so many. Well, look,
first off, I'm a UFO chaser, not a ghosty chaser, even though I grew up in New Orleans chasing ghosts. I leave dead people to people who like to mess with dead people. I figured sooner or later I'm going to be crossing over. I don't want to be crossing over to a bunch of pissed off dead people. You remember when you provoked me? Do you remember that? I got something for you. No. Yeah, y'all can keep that for yourselves.
I love graveyards. When I used to visit my cousins in Charleston, I almost grew up in Charleston. The first thing we do is go to the old graveyards and walk through it. And oh my God, it was so much fun. Especially
the first time a friend of mine told me about the graveyards where he lived, I thought he was lying, because the only graveyards I've ever seen when I was a kid was in New Orleans. They're all above ground. They're not just gravy, you know. So I was expecting these big monuments and stuff. All of I can get out there, it's a bunch of grass with some headstones. I'm like, wow, that's not a graveyard. What is that? It was so disappointing. You know, but hey, it gets bored when you live in the city. I know y'all got Heidi Hollis coming up behind y'all here pretty soon, but I was having fun chatting with y'all, getting into y'all's time.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. This has been fun. And you got to promise me, though, if I do visit.
You come down, I'll show you around, man.
Yeah, the first thing that I want is a hurricane drink, okay?
Oh, yeah. Actually, they got this thing called a 57 Chevy with stolen plates. Ooh, man, it is some good. And they have real mint juleps. Now, I'm going to tell you a little secret. If you don't like strong liquor, do not touch either one of these two drinks I'm talking about. The mint julep sounds all harmless, and like you see it on TV in old days, Southern is drinking a mint julep. Okay, a mint julep is 190, Everclear, and a piece of mint. That's it. That's a mint julep. They wiggle them in and around the Everclear until it's got a mini taste to it. And then that's some potent stuff. And the 57 Chevys are 151 Everclear with a double shot. But they're this kind of – it's made with orange juice, grenadine, and something else. And you don't really taste the alcohol until after you drink it. I don't know how they do it. You don't even taste it, and you're like standing in Austin. You're like, wow, I got a buzz all of a sudden.
Yeah, you're making me thirsty, and all I got is a
they're good. They make some good drinks down there, man. They really do. And you know what's funny? You can tell them any drink that you've ever heard anywhere in the world. If they can't find it, they'll let you come behind the bar and show them how to make it. They love to learn new drinks down there, because it's just part of being in the Quad.
Well, now you got me excited. I'm going to actually contact
Leo. If you're down here hanging out, we don't, locals don't call it the French Quarter. We call it the Boucaré.
Really? Huh.
Yeah. That's what French Quarter is. Actually, Quarter French is what it means. It's like Baton Rouge is Red Stick. You know, Louisiana's a little backwards sometimes. I'm not exactly sure why. But no, they do really. The locals, the most part of the locals call it the Boucaré. Matter of fact, people bitch when they come down here to go down there. Some of the exits say Boucaré instead of French Quarter. So people know what the hell they're looking at. You know, most people don't speak French, so you're not going to get it anyway. But anyway, I'm going to shut up because I know y'all got to close out and stuff. So let me get out of here.
Yeah,
Hey, thanks for joining us.
This was a blast.
Thank you, my friend. This is y'all great. You too. So we got to end the show now, I guess.
Yeah, because we got Heidi on right. She's right on our heels.
Okay, so can you send me some super glue, or should I maybe use tape for my next? These are my notes I was going to use. Use them for the next show.
You know what I used to do when I couldn't afford tape when I was a student? I used to lick the corners and then stick them together with my tongue.
That's disgusting.
And then let it dry because I couldn't afford tape.
Oh my God. You are so creative. I got to say, people that don't know you, this lady is so creative and very talented. Amazing. So, well, listen, come up with something great next week. We got a couple really nice shows planned with some incredible guests. And thank you, Seraphine. And it's been
a great
pleasure. And I just want to, again, thank Joe for having us on his network and thank Joe for joining us. That was really fun. It really brought back memories of my trip to New Orleans, and I'm kind of like to go back again. And for the listeners on 107.7 FM New Orleans, and those who are listening to us live on YouTube, SoundCloud, iHeart, whatever, thank you for listening. And please tune in next week at same place, same time, same hour, and same corny jokes that I keep telling.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Thank you, Seraphine. Take care. God
Good
bless
night.
Good night.